WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Frank Browning. Earlier today, Iranian press reports said that Kurdish rebels had taken control of much of northeastern Iraq, including the important oil city Kirkuk. Saddam Hussein is apparently now turning his forces against the Kurds, but he'll likely have a tough fight of it. The Kurds are spread out through the mountains of Turkey, Iran, Syria, and they make up about a third of Iraq itself. They are among the oldest and fiercest peoples of the Mideast, some 16 million who have their own language and culture dating back some 2,500 years, but still have no nation to call their own. Originally a mountain people, they are mostly Sunni Muslims, who, according to legend, are descendants of 400 virgins who were raped by devils on the way to King Solomon's court. At the end of the Crusades, it was a Kurdish warrior, Saladin, who brought back Jerusalem to Muslim hands. Today, few Americans know anything of the Kurds beyond the fact that Saddam Hussein used poison gas to suppress their rebellion in 1988. But journalist and anthropologist Bill Beeman, who spent a decade in the Middle East, says that the Kurds have long been at the crossroads of Middle Eastern conflict. And if it turns out that they are able to hold on to Iraq's most valuable resource, the northern oil fields, they will pose a very serious threat to Saddam.
If the Kurds were able to hold and keep the city of Kirkuk, they could essentially be determining the economic future of Iraq, if Iraq holds together as a country altogether, after all. Another thing that's very important is that the Kurdish resistance movement in Iraq has long been supported by Iran. And so therefore, a takeover by Kurdish forces in northern Iraq may also mean an incursion by Iran into the present resistance against Saddam Hussein in Iraq.
Well, there's also a U.S. role in this exchange with Iraq and Iran, isn't there? We were to some degree also supporting the Kurdish rebels, weren't we?
Yes, we were, and in particular in this last particular fray, where we were involved with Baghdad and where we were fighting Saddam Hussein directly, we saw the Kurds as potential troublemakers for Saddam Hussein, and so there was a degree of support for the Kurdish resistance movement coming through Turkey, of course.
And there's a phrase that one hears regularly, though, about the Kurds. It's that the Kurds have no friends.
That's right.
Even though we may have been friends, or that the Iranians may have been friends in one moment, or the Iraqis, at root, the Kurds still keep no friends.
That's correct. The Kurds have not been well served by anybody. They've been willing to take aid where they can, either primarily, however, from outside sources, from Iran. There's been some degree of support for one of the Kurdish groups in the past from Syria and also from Libya. But in general, in the countries in which they live, they are very, very badly treated. The Iranians, of course, under the Shah, were quite suspicious of the Kurds because in 1946, they, in conjunction with the Soviet Union, formed an independent Kurdish republic, the so-called Mahabad Republic. And so the Shah was deeply suspicious of the communist influences that might have taken hold among the Kurds. Of course, Iraq has suppressed the Kurds regularly, and they're fearful that a rebellion there would cut them off from their oil supplies. Turkey has really done the worst of all. And many Kurds in Turkey, and they, by the way, that's the largest group of Kurds in the Middle East, don't even know that they are Kurds. They've been called Mountain Turks by the actual Turks for a long time. They've been forbidden to speak their own language, and there really has been a general cultural repression of Kurdish identity in Turkey altogether.
So where are we? I mean, we have these reports that the Kurds may now be presenting the most severe threat to Saddam Hussein's survival as head of Iraq. We see the Iranians conceivably arming both the Kurds and the rebels in the south. Where do you see this playing out? What role can you imagine they may have in the future of Iraq? And just how much do you suppose they can rely upon the Iranians as long as ongoing backers?
There are several degrees to which the Kurds would like to have some degree of independence. There, on the one hand, there are some that press for a totally independent Kurdish state. Now, this would be pretty viable, actually, given the fact that the Kurds sit on so much oil. Nevertheless, they have no industrial infrastructure. They are in Iraq. There are no real large Kurdish cities. And for the most part, the Kurds in Iraq belong to one particular faction of Kurds, one cultural faction, if you like. And this particular faction, the Kurmanji faction, is considered to be rather brave and manly, but nevertheless not as well educated or as able to carry out a statesman-like government. The southern faction, the Sorani faction, are more more urban, better educated, but primarily live in Iran. So it's not clear, really, that an independent and autonomous Kurdistan made up of the northern Iraqi territory could really survive as an independent country. Now, a milder version of this that's pressed by a number of the Kurdish resistance groups is that there be a Kurdish autonomous region, but not an independent state. And this is...
Well, I'll explain what this means. These are people attempting to carve out a life in a mountainous zone. And what do these terms mean?
Well, an independent state would be just that. That is, there'd be total self-determination. There'd be no ties with Baghdad or any other state. They'd make their own foreign relations, and they would essentially be on a tub on its own bottom in trying to pursue their economic future and their cultural future. And as I say, it would be a landlocked country with no outlet to the sea, and they'd be totally dependent on their neighbors for their export of oil because it would all have to go through pipelines. So that would be a very difficult situation to pursue for a state. Other landlocked states, such as Afghanistan, have lots of trouble getting in and out of the region. There's also not very good road transportation into Kurdistan or out of it.
Right. So, and an autonomous region, on the other hand, within Iraq.
Right. An autonomous region within Iraq would be a region that was still tied to the Baghdad government. Nevertheless, Baghdad would still conduct all foreign relations for the entire territory, would probably regulate the general economics of the entire country. But in terms of, let's say, things like education or local economic questions, they would have total autonomy. That is, it would not be governed from Baghdad. And in particular, the Kurds would like for once to be able to have education in their own language, because Kurdish is a language. It's not Arabic. It's not Persian. It's not Turkish. It really is a very separate language. It even has a literature, but the difficulty has been that people have not been allowed to speak it or write in it in most countries.
Bill, you were just explaining that the Kurds have long wanted a place of their own, a home of their own, a nation of their own. It doesn't seem too likely they're going to get it right away. But what is it that would happen within that place? Give us a sense. Put some clothes on these people. Who are they? What would happen? Give us some sense of their language, the tone and texture of what a Kurdish home would be.
Well, Kurds are now, I guess you could say, divided between rather urbanized, modern people who have had a Western-style education. These mostly live in either the large cities of Iraq, like Kirkuk, or in the large cities in Iran, like Sanandaj or Kermanshah, or Rezaieh, which are important Iranian cities in the western part of Iran. The other group of Kurds are still mountain-living tribespeople who are fiercely independent. They have a very rich culture, and they are a a reputation for being rather closed off from other ethnic groups in the region. They are crack horsemen, crack shooters. They have a very distinctive ethnic dress, and also, as I've said before, a language which is quite distinct from any language in the region.
We're not talking about an Arab people here, but we are talking about an Islamic people.
That's correct. They're an Islamic people. Interestingly, the Kurds are mostly Sunni, but there are also quite a few Shiite Kurds who live in Iran. And in Turkey, there are a number of Kurds that are allied with the Alevi Bektashi movement, which is another branch, actually, of Shiism, and which has been considered threatening by the Turkish government. So even though they are all Muslims, of course, there are various religious groups represented within the Kurdish community. I think it's fair to say that the Kurds are primarily an ethnic group, then, rather than a religious group. And because of their great antiquity as a people, they have a set of traditions that go back thousands of years.
My guest is Bill Beeman, an anthropologist who specialized in Middle Eastern cultures. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Bill Beeman. We've been talking about Kurds in the Middle East and their role in the current conflict between Iraq and its neighbors. And you've spoken about the attempt by the Turkish government to assimilate its Kurdish population.
That's right.
But what's a day in the life of a Kurdish family in Turkey like? What do they see to lose, and what are they attempting to preserve?
If a child, for instance, comes to school in Turkey and speaks Kurdish, the child is likely to be beaten and told that he's not to speak this strange dialect. If a Kurd in Turkey cannot conduct any business at all in Turkey with using Kurdish, the Kurdish names have been forbidden in official records in Turkey, so that there really has been an attempt to try to totally eradicate the Kurdish culture in Turkey per se.
There's a question of loss of language, of how one transacts business. Do we see distinct differences in the family lives within Kurdish communities or Turkish or Iraqi, say in marriage rites and rituals or that sort of thing?
Absolutely. Kurdish customs are very distinctive. The Kurds follow a general Middle Eastern marriage pattern. That is that that father's brother's daughter marriage is favored in Kurdistan, as it is in many parts of the Middle East.
Run that by us a little more
sorry.
Clearly.
Cousin marriage, essentially, is favored in Kurdistan, as it is in much of the Middle East. Nevertheless, it is a particularly strong tool in Kurdish life for political alliance between different families and different tribal factions, so that we look at marriage as a very important political tool as well as an important social tool.
And there are ceremonies that are reflective of these alliances as well as of the actual marriage itself?
Well, marriage ceremonies, like ceremonies in many parts of the world, celebrate not only the union of two people, but also the cultures from which they come. And a Kurdish marriage ceremony celebrates essentially the Kurdish cultural spirit as well as the union between two families.
How does that happen?
Well, first of all, the marriage ceremonies last for many, many days. They are ceremonies when people get their national dress out, including a very specific Kurdish costume. Men in Kurdistan wear a kind of baggy trouser and tunic, and also a very distinctive headdress with a kind of fringe on it. You can't possibly forget a Kurdish man in full dress once you've seen him. It's a very, very distinctive costume. And Kurdish women also have a series of distinctive costumes, which vary a little bit from region to region. It includes full skirts, a jacket and tunic, and also a particular series of headdresses and headbands that are adorned with coins and jewelry of one sort or another. It's modest dress by Islamic standards, but not a veil as we find in Iran or other parts of the country. It's very colorful. Actually, these clothes are worn in Kurdish villages day in and day out on a regular basis. So a wedding consists of oftentimes contests such as horse riding contests, shooting contests, a lot of dancing, both male and female dancing, good food. And a general celebration of Kurdish life, as well as a celebration of the marriage between two partners.
And those partners, as you say, may even be first cousins, in which you're building an alliance of what, economic importance, or?
That's correct. You're in the marriage between cousins. You're actually consolidating your economic resources in a family. And you're making sure that the economic resources from an earlier generation stay within one particular line. Now, another kind of marriage could be a marriage outside of the family, and that's almost always done in order to try to gain new relationships with other families or with other tribal groups. So it's an alliance kind of marriage, and that's, as I say, these patterns are not unique to Kurds. They occur throughout the Middle East. But because Kurdish tribal life is so strong, these patterns are very, very common in Kurdistan, especially in the mountainous regions, in a way that they have ceased to become important in urban areas. I should also mention that Kurdish music is one of the finest folk music traditions in the Middle East. It's not very well known in the West, but it is a distinctive tradition. It's not Arabic music and not Persian music at all, but a very distinctive musical form, and it's one thing that the Kurds are especially proud of. And it's very difficult for Kurds in Turkey because they may, in fact, be arrested for singing a Kurdish song in public, and they have been in the past.
I can well imagine that secular leaders who have a vision of modernizing their countries might very well see these sorts of traditional marriages, which are, I presume, alliances really between men in which the women become the point of alliance, they might see these traditions as antithetical to modernizing.
Well, we have to remember that the nations of the region, Turkey, Iran, and Iraq, have all been involved in a modern ethic of modernization. The father of modern Turkey, Ataturk, of course, was interested in modernizing his country with a vengeance. And he was interested in eradicating all forms of traditional culture in favor of trying to establish Western industry, Western cultural institutions, and also a Western-style democracy. And this was, it's quite understandable, given this extraordinary drive toward modernization, why the present government of Turkey, carrying on in Ataturk's tradition, would want to eradicate these traditional cultures and try to develop a homogeneous national culture for Turkey. I think that's really where it comes from. I think it may not be a drive directed specifically against the Kurds because Turks hate Kurds. It's because the Turks want a homogeneous nation state. And they know that when you have an autonomous cultural region like Kurdistan, that gets in the way of establishing a real Western-style nation state.
Bill, it occurs to me that forces that would like to see modernism and democratic participation might very well run up against these same sorts of problems with their ethnic minorities, be they Kurdish or otherwise. that it isn't only despots who are likely to have these problems, but that it's unclear how ethnic minorities are going to function in what the West likes to call a modern democratic country.
That's right. It is a difficult problem, and I, not to get too far afield, but I should mention that even in the United States, we have the English First Movement, which is essentially a way of trying to express our concern with the same problem here in the United States. Now, what do we do if we have an ethnic minority that grows up speaking another language than English as their first language? So this is a problem of essentially state building. But what we have to recognize is that the world really does not consist entirely of nation states. And the nation-state question is, I think, going to be increasingly an important one for us. We have places like Turkey, like Iraq, and like Iran, which look outwardly to be nation-states. They have governments and parliaments, but on the other hand, they have these very, very important ethnic groups who identify primarily with their ethnicity or with their religion, rather than with their adherence to any loyalty to any particular state. And this is, as I say, an enormous problem. Unfortunately, it's been addressed by many of these countries by trying to eradicate these cultural traditions, making the speaking of a language or the singing of a song illegal in order to try to force people to assimilate to some broader cultural tradition, or by gassing them or bombing them when they don't do what the central government wants. This, unfortunately, is not only cruel and really inhuman, but it also does not work in the long run. That is, when you're talking about 16 to 20 million people, you can't really eradicate their culture that easily. Cultures don't die very, very quickly.
My guest has been anthropologist Bill Beeman. He teaches at Brown University and has spent many years in the Middle East. I'm Frank Browning. This is Fresh Air.